From Iowa Public Radio News, I'm Ben Kiefer. This is The Exchange. An estimated 2,200 Iowans are living with HIV or AIDS. This hour, we'll discuss efforts to raise awareness about the disease in conjunction with World AIDS Day this week. We'll talk with John Chamberlain. John has been living with HIV for the past 14 years and is an AIDS educator. We'll also talk about prevention efforts throughout the state and talk with AIDS specialist Dr. Jeff Meyer of the University of Iowa Hospitals and Clinics about a recent study which shows how taking antiretroviral medication can reduce the chance of contracting HIV. Has HIV or AIDS affected your life or that of a loved one? Share your story this hour. It starts right after the news. It's The Exchange from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. About 2,200 Iowans, it's estimated, are living with HIV or AIDS. This hour, we want to discuss efforts to raise awareness about the disease in conjunction with World AIDS Day, which was this week. We also want to discuss prevention efforts throughout the state and talk about a recent study which shows how taking antiretroviral medication can reduce the chance of contracting HIV. We also want to find out what's on your mind concerning this topic. Listeners, has HIV or AIDS affected your life or the life of a loved one? Share your story with us this hour, 1-866-780-9100. The Exchange at iowapublicradio.org is our email. We're also on Twitter at IPR Talk. And my guests initially, John Chamberlain in our Des Moines studio. He's an AIDS educator who has HIV, vice president of a group called Positive Iowans Taking Charge. Good afternoon, John.
Good afternoon, Ben.
Also with John in our Des Moines studio, Randy Mayer, chief of the Iowa Department of Public Health's Bureau of HIV, STD, and Hepatitis. Randy Mayer, welcome to our program.
Thank you.
And in the Iowa City studio of Iowa Public Radio, Dr. Jeff Meyer, associate professor of internal medicine and an infectious disease specialist with the University of Iowa Healthcare HIV program, also site director of the Midwest AIDS Training and Education Center. Dr. Meyer, thank you for making time for us.
Thank you.
Let's start with you, John Chamberlain. You have been living with HIV for many years. How and when did you contract it?
I was diagnosed in 1996. I don't know exactly when I contracted it. It could have been in my body for up to 10 years before that. I assume that I was probably infected in the early 90s.
Do you know how?
Well, it could have been through a combination of things. I was a cocaine user in the 80s, and I was also had what I like to call a very healthy sex life.
Mm-hmm. Now, how has your health been? How is it now?
My health is great now. I have an undetectable viral load. My CD4 numbers, which detect how much my body's able to fight the disease, are in great numbers. And I have been that way for ever since I've been on the medicines, which is about 10 years now.
Tell us, what medications are you taking to fight it?
My AIDS meds are Epsicom and Reataz. I take Reataz twice a day, once in the morning and once in the evening. And I take the Epsicom in the evening also. But then I have probably 10 or so other meds that help me deal with the side effects of the medications that I'm taking.
Well, how serious are those side effects?
They can be quite serious. Diarrhea is probably my hugest enemy. Migraines, lack of appetite, depression, anxiety. I already said migraines, but so I take several different medicines and then have to deal with the interactions of those medicines with each other and constantly day by day decide what I need to do to get through that day.
John, I want to come back to you to talk about Positive Iowans Taking Charge in just a moment, but first I want to turn to Randy Mayer of the Iowa Department of Public Health. How many people are in John's situation living with HIV or AIDS in Iowa?
Well, in Iowa we have 1,750 diagnosed people who were diagnosed while they were living in Iowa. And then we estimate there are roughly another 500 people who have HIV who have not been diagnosed yet and are living with HIV.
Mm-hmm. In recent years, are the number of people with the disease getting diagnosed, is that increasing or decreasing?
We've seen a pretty continuous trend of increasing diagnoses since about 2000 or 1999. And it's increasing very slowly, so about 4 more people per year get diagnosed. Mm-hmm. Last year, we had about 127 diagnoses, and that's right in the ballpark for us.
Mm-hmm. Is that the increase in the diagnosed number of cases necessarily a bad thing, or just that we'll be getting more people diagnosed, fewer of them unknown?
You're exactly right. We hope, it's a little bit difficult to tell, but we hope that we're reaching a lot of those people who have not been diagnosed. And if we are successful in some of our prevention programs and our counseling and testing programs, we expect that we will see increased diagnoses for a number of years before the trend starts to go the other way.
Mm-hmm.
Now, some states are able to estimate or measure how many people are actually getting infected versus how many are just getting diagnosed. We don't have that ability here because we don't have enough cases to work with to use that technology to estimate how many people are. And the way they do that is they look at how many people who are diagnosed were recently infected, and you can tell that by the amount of antibody in their blood.
Mm-hmm. If you're hopeful because you see these numbers of diagnosed cases growing, that people are more apt to get checked out and get diagnosed and then, of course, get treatment, what factors do you think have led to the increase here in the diagnosed cases?
Two things. We have a number of test sites that we fund from the Department of Public Health, and we really have been working with them for many years on ways to find people who may need to be tested. And a lot of those techniques are called social network testing. It's really following up on people who have been recently diagnosed to find out who their partners or contacts might have been, or who else might be in their social networks, because people in their social networks are probably more likely to have the same risk factors and to have been exposed to HIV in the same way that maybe they were. So that's one way that I think testing is improving and reaching more of the people who need to be reached. The other way is in 2006, the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention came out with new guidelines for HIV testing in healthcare settings. And the recommendation was that in most areas of the country where HIV is fairly common, they recommend that everyone be tested by their healthcare provider at least once in their life. And for people who have risk factors, they get tested annually. I think those recommendations have helped physicians to do a better job of asking people about their risk factors and just routinely testing people and conveying to them that this is a routine part of healthcare. If you haven't been tested for HIV, we'd like to do that now. And it certainly seems like some of our diagnoses have been coming from the private community of healthcare providers. And so although I don't really know that the number of tests have gone up in that community, it certainly seems like they have.
Let me turn to Dr. Jeff Meyer of the University of Iowa Hospitals and Clinics, site director of the Midwest AIDS Training and Education Center. Remind us, what do we know about the different ways in which someone can contract HIV and AIDS?
Well, we've known for many years that you can get HIV through sex. You can get it through blood. So exposure to blood products that are contaminated with the virus or contain the virus can transmit it that way. You can get it from transmission from mom to baby during delivery. And sometimes it could be transmitted in breast milk.
Mm-hmm. And remind us the difference between HIV and AIDS.
Well, HIV is the virus that causes the infection. And AIDS is actually a sort of clinical illness that develops as a consequence of the HIV infection. And the Center for Disease Control has sort of provided a case definition of AIDS. And so we follow that case definition. And these are individuals who have had a lot of damage to their immune system. And so John had talked about the CD4 count. Okay, that's a marker of how the immune system is doing. And when that count becomes low, very low, less than 200, for an example, as a number, you're prone to getting unusual infections and cancers.
Dr. Jeff Meyer with us, along with John Chamberlain and Randy Mayer, 1-866-780-9100 this hour, talking about AIDS and HIV, if it's affected your life or that of a loved one. We'd like to hear from you. Share your story this hour. Also, we're talking about the stigma attached with this disease, if you have a story about that. 1-866-780-9100, the exchange at iowapublicradio.org is our email. We're also on Twitter at IPR Talk. Ali is joining us from Wahpeton. Is it Ali?
Hello.
Yes. Is this Ali? Did I get your name right?
Yes, you did.
Hi. Welcome to our program. You're calling from where?
Wahpeton, Iowa.
Excellent. What have you got to tell us about today?
AIDS has affected me in a very deep way, right? Because my sister died of it. She died of it in San Francisco. My tree facility took care of her. They were very excellent, provided medical marijuana, which I truly believe in. And there's a lot of embarrassment up here around Northwest Iowa with having someone that died of HIV/AIDS.
Mm-hmm. Ali, is it something you talk about here in Iowa, or have learned that it's best not to talk about it? How do you deal with that? You've identified it has a stigma where you are.
I correct people when they seem to have wrong ideas about HIV and AIDS. And I had to have an AIDS test in Iowa City, and that's where I get my medical care from, and it all worked out well, but I was scared to have one, and people should not be scared.
Mm-hmm. Ali, thank you very much for your call coming from Wahpeton. Let's talk about one of the points that Ali mentioned. Medical marijuana and other treatments, Dr. Meyer. The latest treatments, medical marijuana, would be to help deal with some of the side effects of the treatments, or also just the fact that you have it. Tell us about the treatments in fighting the disease, and then also in comforting the patient.
So the treatments for the infection are sort of the antiretroviral medications that John had mentioned. Because it's a tricky virus, it's clever, it can mutate quickly, it can get around some of the medications, and so we have to combine medications that are effective. And typically we would give three very active medications and combine those three to treat the virus. And some of these medications have been sort of combined into one pill, mm-hmm. Which makes it easier. So it requires an effective antiviral drug regimen to control the virus to keep it from infecting other immune cells that it destroys. In terms of managing some of the side effects, as you know, Iowa doesn't allow the use of medical marijuana, medical marijuana has been used to treat some of the side effects associated with the HIV medications, and some of those might be nausea, vomiting. Sometimes it's been used for in cases where there's been pain of nerve pain that's been perhaps caused by some of the medications. And so it's also FDA product like marijuana, Marinol, has been FDA approved for use in patients who have HIV who have difficult time eating. So lack of appetite, so it's an appetite booster, and that's one of the benefits of using the medication. And that can actually be poor appetite can either be part of the process of having HIV, or it can be perhaps a side effect of the medication.
One of the other points that Ali, our caller, just a moment ago brought up, I want to put to John Chamberlain, because I know you are the vice president of a group called Positive Iowans Taking Charge, goes by the acronym PITCH. And I understand this is a group that, at least in part, fights the stigma attached to HIV/AIDS, which is exactly what Ali was talking about. Tell us about your organization.
We do exactly that. We're a group of all positive Iowans living with HIV. We speak regularly to high schools and colleges. Pretty much anyone that will listen, we'll speak to. We also serve as an organization to help fight the stigma that we ourselves carry by holding a wellness summit every spring for 3 days. We have a camp down at Lake Aquabi, and it gives people from across the state the chance to come together and meet other people like themselves. And it turns out to be quite an empowering experience for most of our guests.
Tell us, John, what is behind the stigma? What have you learned is behind that, the factors that feed it?
Well, HIV and AIDS is thought of as a dirty disease. It involves sexuality. It involves blood. There's a lack of ignorance or a lack of intelligence about how the disease is spread. There's a fear that continues because we simply don't want to talk about it. Many of the old stereotypes I have encountered recently living here in Iowa.
Mm-hmm. I want to talk further about the stigma a little bit later, but I know Randy Mayer of the Iowa Department of Public Health has to leave us halfway through the show, and I want to talk about prevention efforts in the state. Randy, before we say goodbye to you, tell us, what is the state doing in preventing the spread of HIV/AIDS?
The department receives about $1.7 million from the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention for HIV prevention specifically. Much of that money gets turned back out to communities to address HIV prevention. So we contract with a number of agencies across the state that deliver several types of programs. One set of programs are called health education and risk reduction programs. They're behaviorally based programs, and they are targeted at certain priority populations, and the community helps us choose those priority populations based on the epidemiology in Iowa. And so we have programs in Des Moines that are targeted towards men who have sex with men, and we have programs targeted towards African Americans and Latinos in Des Moines. And we also have other programs in other parts of the state for injection drug users, and high-risk heterosexuals as well.
Mm-hmm. And we'll actually hear from one of the supervisor of one of those programs, organizations in the second half of the show, the AIDS Project of Central Iowa, in the second half of the show. How do you evaluate how well this money is working?
Well, we have a lot of requirements on us from the Centers for Disease Control to show that we're using the money effectively. So we have a web-based reporting system, and our contractors are required to report back to us on each of the programs that they deliver and how many people came to those. And some of them do pre- and post-test sorts of things. It sort of depends on what type of program they're doing. We check to see how many people came to how many sessions and completed the program. Things like that. And then we watch the epidemiology across the state as well.
How does Iowa compare to other states in terms of both in terms of those diagnosed with HIV and AIDS and also in terms of the resources for prevention and treatment?
We're considered a low incidence state, meaning that we have fewer cases than most states. And our resources follow that as well. So we have lower resources than a lot of states. We try to use those resources wisely by having the community help us decide what the best interventions are for a state like Iowa, the ones that seem to make sense and can be delivered by the types of organizations that we have in the state. In terms of our actual epidemic, Iowa's epidemic reflects pretty closely what's going on nationally. So the group that is most affected nationally and in Iowa are men who have sex with men, so gay and bisexual men. In Iowa, they make up about 50 to 60% of the diagnoses each year. But at the same time, while we have a fairly low number of cases among African Americans, because we have such a small population of African Americans in the state, that's a heavily impacted group. If you actually look at the rate of diagnoses per 100,000, African Americans in the state are 8 to 10 times more likely to acquire HIV in Iowa than are whites or other groups. And Latinos are about twice as likely as whites to acquire HIV in Iowa.
So we
target our programs largely at those groups.
Has the budget shortfalls, which a lot of states are encountering, the bad economy, affected at all the resources that are given to the prevention treatment of AIDS in Iowa?
Well, yes and no. We don't have state funding directed towards HIV prevention, so a lot of the shortfalls that states have been having lately have affected HIV prevention programs in those states that had a lot of state funding. We rely solely on federal funding for our programs, and while we haven't seen huge cutbacks in that, we haven't seen any increases either. We've been working with the same amount of money for 8 years now, and if you look at inflation as part of that, that's actually been a decrease of more than 20% in the amount of funds that we have to spend on prevention.
You're estimating, you said on the outset, that was it something like 500 people, you estimate, roughly in Iowa, undiagnosed, who have HIV or AIDS. Is that correct? Something like
that's
that?
That's correct.
Now,
yeah.
What do you say to a person who thinks they may be carrying HIV right now? What is the recommendation you have before you leave us?
Early testing and frequent testing is really important for us. So as Dr. Myers talked about, we really do have some great medications. And the recommendations are to start those treatments or medications earlier and earlier in the course of the disease. And the outcomes improve and the quality of life improves with the earlier you're able to start those medications. So finding out that you're positive is very important, and not only for your own outcomes, but we also know that most of the transmissions of HIV occur from people who have not yet been diagnosed. So twice as many transmissions come from people who haven't been diagnosed as those who have been diagnosed and are trying to live with the disease.
Okay, Randy Mayer, we want to say thanks to you, Chief of the Iowa Department of Public Health's Bureau of HIV, STD, and Hepatitis. We appreciate you coming into our Des Moines studio today.
Thank you.
When we come back, we'll continue our conversation with Dr. Jeff Meyer of the University of Iowa Hospitals and Clinics, the director of the Midwest AIDS Training and Education Center. Also, John Chamberlain with us. He is with a group called Positive Iowans Taking Charge, PITCH, dealing with the stigma attached to AIDS and HIV. And when we come back, we'll talk to the Prevention Services Supervisor, also with the AIDS Project of Central Iowa. Darren Whitfield will join us. We'd like to have you join us in this conversation this afternoon. Has HIV or AIDS affected your life or that of a loved one? Share your story with us this hour. Perhaps you've experienced the stigma attached with this disease. 1-866-780-9100, 1-866-780-9100. The Exchange at iowapublicradio.org is our email. We're also on Twitter at IPR Talk. We'll be back in just a moment with more of The Exchange from Iowa Public Radio News. Great to have you with us on this edition of The Exchange over the noon hour. I'm Ben Kiefer on Iowa Public Radio's news stream and talking about AIDS and HIV this hour. An estimated 2,200 Iowans are living with HIV or AIDS. This hour we're discussing efforts to raise awareness about the disease, the stigma connected with it, prevention efforts throughout the state, and the latest in medical advancements to fight HIV and AIDS. My guest, John Chamberlain, AIDS educator who has HIV, has had it for the past 14 years at least. He's been diagnosed with it. Vice president of a group called Positive Iowans Taking Charge, PITCH. Also, Dr. Jeff Meyer with us, associate professor of internal medicine and an infectious disease specialist with the University of Iowa Healthcare HIV Program, site director of the Midwest AIDS Training and Education Center. We want to reach out to you, our listeners, this hour. Has HIV or AIDS affected your life or that of a loved one? Tell us how. Share your story. 1-866-780-9100. The Exchange at iowapublicradio.org is our email, or we're on Twitter, also at IPR Talk. And last week, AIDS researchers and activists, you heard the news, probably celebrated after news that a daily pill can do a lot to prevent HIV/AIDS. It's a study published in the New England Journal of Medicine. It reported that healthy gay men who took an antiretroviral pill called Truvada were up to a 73% less likely to become infected than those who took a placebo. And I want to turn to Dr. Jeff Meyer to ask your reaction to this. Was this new?
Well, I think this is really good news to really prove a concept that putting antiviral medications in pills and giving them prior to an exposure to HIV can actually decrease the risk of or rate of HIV infection.
Can you explain that for those of us who are not doctors, how that works in the body?
Okay. So the pill that was mentioned in the study, Truvada, is actually a combination of two different antiviral medications. And you take this, and this is convenient because you can put both medications in the same pill, and you can take it just once a day because these medications get into your tissues and they stay there for some time. And so if you are exposed to HIV, HIV needs to set up shop in your tissues, in your mucosa, for instance, and replicate to really get a foothold. And these medications prevent that from happening. This is really one of probably a half a dozen studies, or yeah, around roughly six studies that I'm aware of that are being done internationally, taking a look at various approaches that really use antiviral medications to prevent infection.
So this would fall in the category, if I'm understanding you correctly, of not a cure-all, but another very important tool added to fight HIV and AIDS.
Yeah, that is correct. This is only one tool in a toolbox of prevention measures that are taken. In fact, these studies, the two studies that have actually been published, the one involving a pill and another one involving a gel that you use with barrier protection like condoms, okay, have been found to be beneficial. But they've all been done in the context of a comprehensive prevention protocol that the patients were educated about how to prevent HIV infection, the subjects were, and they were also given, in one case, one study, they were actually given condoms, and in the other case, they were educated, you know, that you really need to be using protection condoms in addition to using this pill in order to have a full effect of preventing infection.
Dr. Jeff Meyer of the University of Iowa Hospitals and Clinics. We want to introduce a new guest to our conversation in our studio in Des Moines. Darren Whitfield is with us. He's Prevention Services Supervisor with the AIDS Project of Central Iowa. Good afternoon, Darren, and thank you for coming into our studio.
Good afternoon, Ben. How are you?
I'm great. And tell us, what is the AIDS Project of Central Iowa? What do you do?
Yeah, well, the AIDS Project of Central Iowa, we're one of the largest AIDS service organizations in the state. We provide comprehensive both HIV prevention and also care services to people living with HIV and then impacted by the disease.
Mm-hmm.
Randy was talking earlier, we were one of the agencies that are funded through the Iowa Department of Public Health to provide prevention services, an array of programming to individuals who are at a higher risk for HIV infection throughout the state.
And how would you gauge your efforts at prevention right now? How do you evaluate and what trends are you seeing?
I would say that we do very well. We do constant program evaluations on an array of programs that we provide. We offer community-level interventions, so they are programs that are designed to reach a broad range of individuals within a particular population with HIV prevention information and services. And we also provide group-level interventions where we have a smaller number of individuals that go through a program to address HIV prevention and barriers, and as well as providing counseling and testing at our location and through outreach efforts in the community. So we're always constantly working with the community and seeking input from the community to develop these programs so that they have the impact and the effectiveness that is needed to constantly be reducing the rate of HIV infections.
Donald is joining us from Iowa City, 1-866-780-9100. If you have would like to share your story, you've been affected by HIV or AIDS especially, or have a question, 1-866-780-9100. Donald, welcome to our program.
Yeah, hi, Ben. Glad I could join in today. I did want to talk a little bit about something you referred to earlier about Truvada being used as a prophylaxis against HIV. It needs to be kept in mind that these drugs are not without side effects. And in some small way, I think that pushing the idea of taking Truvada as a prophylaxis against HIV puts a lot of money in the hands of pharmaceutical corporations. Truvada is a drug that lowers bone density, for instance. It's not a drug that you want to take for no reason.
Okay, Donald, let's go to our specialist in that field, Dr. Jeff Meyer, because John Chamberlain also raised the point about side effects, and now you have too. So let's ask Dr. Meyer about the length and breadth of side effects a person can experience while on these drugs.
Yeah, I'm glad that Donald actually raised that issue, because I think it is an important issue when considering studies, the sort of the public health implications of studies like the one that was just reported in New England Journal of Medicine. He's correct that there are potential side effects associated with Truvada. They're not frequent, but they do occur, and they could be perhaps kidney side effect, a problem that could develop with the kidneys as a consequence of taking a medication like that every day. Again, it's not very frequent, but it's possible. There's also the possibility of perhaps development of resistance to the medications, and so that if it's taken by a large population and there is a possibility that the virus might get around those medications, because we don't typically use Truvada by itself to treat HIV infection. So it's possible virus can become resistant to the medication, and then you end up generating a population of virus that could be maybe even transmitted from one person to another that is resistant to the medication. So
the issue, however, is pretty common. And I don't know that we really want to have a lot of 45-year-old men running around with the bone densities of 75-year-old women. So that is something to be certainly considered. Certainly that beats, you know, running around being HIV positive. But on the other hand, there is safer sex. Mm-hmm. And I think that's what people really need to emphasize.
Donald, thank you very much for your views. Yes, go ahead.
The real issue that I called in was an issue of HIV stigma and the fact that Iowa has one of the most draconian HIV criminalization laws in the United States. And it's also a law that's misused constantly and was misused against me. I was brought up on an assault charge in which I was actually defending myself, and a gentleman stuck his finger in my mouth and I bit him. HIV was used at my trial to convict me of assault mm-hmm. from someone who actually assaulted me. And this happened here in Johnson County.
Okay, Donald. Thank you for your call today. Donald calling from Iowa City, 1-866-780-9100, the exchange at iowapublicradio.org. I wanted to go back to the idea of the problem of stigma. John Chamberlain in our studios in Des Moines. You are vice president of a group called Positive Iowans Taking Charge, PITCH. Now, what are the ways that you can prevent a stigma? What do you talk about when you go out and talk to groups? What is the best path there?
I've found that the best thing to do is to just simply share your story to let other people who do not have the disease know what it's like to have HIV and what it's like to be pushed to the fringes of society and misunderstood. Our second fold is to share our story with people who are HIV positive,
so that they then will not become isolated and alone. Isolation is one of the biggest problems that comes along with the stigma of this disease. You don't want your neighbors to know. You don't want your – in some cases, people don't want their families to know. The fact that it's thought of as such a dirty and almost self-deserving disease creates an isolation across the state that is difficult to fight. And going back to the criminalization law, that – really does not help any with the stigma. Also, the law that the gentleman was speaking about was written in the, I think mid-80s, and it still continues to show what stigma lies out there. I think Darren can probably speak to that better than I can.
Mm-hmm. Darren, please do.
Yes, I want to raise several points that I think were mentioned. One, about the criminal transmission law. And I do want to clarify that while in name it is a transmission law, in fact, it is an exposure law.
What is the law? What does the law state? Do you have wording in your head?
I do have wording in my head. Actually, the law states that a person who knowingly knows that they are HIV positive, if they are to expose someone or if there is a potential for transmission to another individual without there being knowledge previously to them having that encounter, they can be brought up on criminal and civil charges. So you don't actually have to transmit HIV based on this law to be prosecuted by it. There has to just be an act in which there is a chance in which you could infect the person. And I think in almost all of the cases that have been prosecuted in the state of Iowa, no one has actually transmitted the virus to the other individual, but they have been brought up on criminal charges based on that law. And so while I think there's definitely some good backing why that law was created, and I think mm-hmm. there's some good reasoning, I think that there definitely needs to be a look at how that impacts not only individuals living with HIV, but the criminalization of it. And I think that goes to also speak to other ways in which stigma plays out in this disease. We unfortunately have this law which sort of gives us a legal backing, but also we have, you know, in this state, it is unfortunate, and throughout the country, it's unfortunate that we don't talk about HIV in the way in which we talk about other chronic diseases. We don't talk about breast cancer the same way that we talk about HIV. We have a very different reaction when
well,
we hear
one,
that someone...
one is communicable and the other is not, though. That would explain part of it, a large part of it, right?
Yes. I mean, yes, HIV is definitely a communicable disease in which someone there was some risk and exposure to the disease. However, I think that when we think about the treatment of people living with a chronic disease, they are not equal. And I think that is where we have stigma of people afraid to be tested for the disease, which increases the spread. And we also have people then unable to share their stories and to live in isolation and be unable to access services because they are afraid that they will, one, be denied services. They are afraid that they will be discriminated against. I think there is plenty of examples of people who have been mm-hmm. discriminated against because they have HIV for accessing services such as housing, accessing services such as employment. I mean, these examples are not few and far between, but they happen quite often in this country where people are denied basic services because they're living with HIV.
Darren Whitfield, thank you. I want to comment from Dr. Meyer about this. How concerned are you, Dr. Meyer, about the connection between stigma and people's willingness to get tested? Do you measure that? Are you concerned about that?
Well, I do think that is an important factor. I think that the concern about stigma and the concern about discrimination is an impediment to getting tested. Mm-hmm. I think that there is some feeling that the criminalization law of as has already been mentioned, the disclosure law that Iowa has on the books can be a deterrent to getting tested in some communities. So I think that all of those factors can impact on the uptake of testing.
Mm-hmm. And as the director of the Midwest AIDS Training and Education Center, what is your work, the tie-in between the stigma and the mental health issues connected with AIDS that have been mentioned throughout this hour, the isolation?
Yeah.
What are the concerns there?
Well, I do think that the stigma and the discrimination and just depression is very common in this group, and that certainly doesn't help. And so I do think there are mental health issues that are tied into living with HIV and dealing with the hardships of the disease itself and the, of course, the stigma and fear that you face from the community.
Christine is joining us from Cedar Rapids. She dialed 1-866-780-9100. Christine, welcome to our program.
Thank you for taking my call. I have worked my whole career as a nurse and the last 22 years with HIV, so I'm very interested in the topic and concerned about, you know, the stigma and the effect that I see that it has on people. It does seem to me that we treat HIV differently from other diseases. I don't see people when they meet someone with heart disease saying, why do you think you got this? Do you have a family history, or did you just eat too much, or are you too lazy to exercise? Or, I mean, we don't put that sort of blame on people, but it seems there's really a knee-jerk response with HIV to identify what that person did to get it. And I think we're guilty of this even in the medical field, that although we do have to ask the information to report to the health department, that sometimes there's the feeling, you know, that every single medical history has to start from the beginning and ask that question again. And it seems like it is something that makes it difficult for people to talk about their HIV when it ends up being so much, you know, kind of in their face. I think, I mean, people are willing, you know, to take responsibility, but that doesn't mean that with every person they meet, they want to, you mm-hmm. know, go back over that that territory again. So I was just wondering whether John maybe could comment on that, whether that's a factor in stigma.
Okay, thank you, Christine, for your call from Cedar Rapids. John, yes, and talk about the stigma, and has it increased or decreased, in your opinion, over the 14 years since you've been diagnosed as HIV positive?
Well, I'd like to thank Christine. She was right on target with her comments. Even though I have been involved in fighting AIDS for 30 years, when I moved back to Iowa, I'm from a little town called Sheraton, I made the decision to go out of town to get my prescriptions filled for the fear that in rural Iowa, someone might not understand the disease and it might – I wasn't so much worried about myself, but what it might reflect on my family members. So even someone who has been trained in the correct way to think about this for 30 years – still came back and was afraid to face some of the stigma that I found here in Iowa. I've had the history of living in larger cities who are more knowledgeable about this disease, so I've never really encountered stigma in my own experience until I came back to Iowa. And here I have been once I revealed my status to someone, they actually turned around and walked away. I had a friend who thought that he had to put on blue gloves, surgical gloves, before he could talk to me. I've been spit upon. Now, this doesn't really bother me. This is what, 14 years of being positive and learning how to deal with it creates. But for the average Iowan, this can be incredibly daunting.
Mm-hmm. We have just a few seconds left, about a minute. Dr. Meyer, I want to end by having you look into the future. What can you say about the fight against HIV/AIDS? Will there ever be a cure-all, or simply this step-by-step improvement in prevention and treatment?
Well, I would like to wish there will be a cure-all. I don't see a vaccine that will be available in the near future, but there's certainly some hope in the scientific community in developing something that's going to be effective eventually for prevention. That would be certainly the best solution for prevention. There will be stepwise improvements in prevention, as one of the ones that was mentioned earlier in the program is an example of that. There will be stepwise improvements in the ability to treat this virus. As Randy Mayer had pointed out, we're beginning to treat it earlier with effective medications. And as the medications evolve, they're easier to take and they're less toxic.
Okay, very good. Dr. Jeff Meyer, we'll leave it there. John Chamberlain, Darren Whitfield, all of you, thank you very much for joining us this hour, gentlemen.
Ben, thank you very much for having us.
Thank you.
Thanks.
The Exchange is produced by Alex Hoyer and Catherine Perkins. Production assistance today from Lindsay Moon. In Des Moines, we had help from Rob Dillard. The executive producer of Iowa Public Radio's talk shows is Jeff Schmidt. Our theme music was composed and performed by Dan Knight. Thanks for all the calls, the input today on our show. The Exchange is a production of Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. Thanks for joining us.